Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 277. It's Monday, October 7th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, well, let's get to it. Let's start with a little bit of bad news here, I guess, although not too unsurprising, from Medical Express. U.S. adults in worse health than British counterparts at midlife, finds study. American adults have significantly worse health in midlife compared to their British peers, especially in markers of cardiovascular health, according to a new study published in the International Journal of Epidemiology. The study compared health measures such as smoking habits, weight, cholesterol levels, and blood pressure among American and British adults aged 33 to 46. It found that American adults have worse cardiovascular health and higher levels of obesity than their British counterparts, along with greater disparities in health by socioeconomic factors. For several outcomes, including hypertension, high cholesterol, and obesity, even the most socioeconomically disadvantaged groups in the U.S. had similar or worse health than the most disadvantaged groups in Britain. On the other hand, British adults rated their overall health worse on average and were more likely to smoke. Meaning that basically Americans overestimate or are more optimistic about their health than the British. How British, how American. Our new research shows that although British adults are more likely to believe that their health is poor, they tend to have better cardiovascular health than their U.S. counterparts in midlife. While we were unable to directly investigate the causes of this, we can speculate that differences in levels of exercise, diets, and poverty, and limited access to free healthcare may be driving worse physical health in the U.S. Given political and social similarities between the U.S. and Britain, the U.S. acts as a warning of what the state of health could look like in Britain without the safety net of the National Health Service and a strong welfare system. The unique combination of high inequality and a weak welfare state in the U.S. may prove harmful for all groups throughout the life course. And it might be useful to point out that Britain is usually closer to the U.S. Than other European countries, socially, culturally, and health-wise. So this reality would be even worse compared to other European countries. In a very interesting commentary, that what may differentiate Brits from us is their National Health Service. Of course, we do not have anything resembling a national health program. Okay, well, next up, we have another story from Medical Express that gets at some of the disparities alluded to in that last story. Progress toward cutting racial mortality disparities stalling and reversing. U.S. racial disparities in mortality decreased between 1999 and 2015 for black men, and to 2011 for black women, followed by stagnation or regression, according to a study published in JAMA Network Open. The researchers compared excess age-adjusted mortality rates for the 15 primary underlying causes of death from 1999 to 2020 for black and white U.S. populations. The researchers found that the excess mortality rates for black individuals decreased steadily by an annual mean of 5.7% from 1999 to 2015, and for women an annual decrease of 5.2% from 1999 to 2011. There is an urgent need to determine how best to regain the progress and implement evidence-based interventions to promote health equity, the authors write. And of course, another interesting thing that we're seeing here is that the reversal started earlier, 4 years earlier, for men than it did for women. And this is part of a larger trend that we've seen in mortality in the U.S. It looks like around 2015 was really when wholesale we were getting reversals on gains that had been made in previous generations. Okay, well, next up I'd like to do a series of stories on some of what I call the pillars of health. In this case, sleep, diet, and exercise or movement. First up, from Medical Express, survey shows daytime sleepiness takes a toll on Americans, impacting daily life. A new survey from the American Academy of Sleep Medicine reveals a significant impact of daytime sleepiness on the daily lives of Americans, with nearly 8 in 10, 82% of respondents reporting that it negatively impacts at least one area of their life. In addition, over half, 54% of Americans believe they usually get too little sleep. Daytime sleepiness is more than just an inconvenience. It can affect our ability to function our best, impacting everything from work productivity to personal relationships, said Dr. Alexander Abreu, sleep medicine physician and American Academy of Sleep Medicine spokesperson. Recognize the importance of sufficient, quality sleep is essential for overall health and well-being. According to the survey, 47% of respondents report that sleepiness negatively impacts their productivity, making it challenging to stay focused and complete tasks efficiently. Additionally, 31% of people say that their quality of work suffers due to sleepiness, with men being 13% more likely than women to report a decline in work performance. The impact of sleepiness extends beyond productivity, affecting mental health and personal relationships. Over a third, 38% of Americans, report that daytime sleepiness negatively impacts their mental health, and 24% of people say it impacts their relationships with friends and family. Additionally, one-third of Americans say that daytime sleepiness negatively impacts their memory and mental recall. And 16% of respondents report that their reaction time while driving is negatively impacted as well. These statistics paint a clear picture of the widespread impact of daytime sleepiness, said Dr. Abreu. It's crucial for individuals to recognize the importance of healthy sleep and seek help if they are struggling to sleep well on a regular basis. To prevent daytime sleep, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine recommends that adults should sleep 7 or more hours per night on a regular basis. The Academy also encourages healthy sleep habits, such as maintaining a consistent sleep schedule, creating a restful sleep environment, and addressing any underlying sleep disorders with the help of a healthcare professional. Yes, sleep is vital and a foundation of our health. Okay, well, next up we get to a dietary story here, this from Medical Express. Adding beans and pulses can lead to improved shortfall nutrient intakes and higher diet quality in American diets. I really like this one because if I were to summarize in two words a way to improve your diet, it would be beans, greens. Eat more of those. That's about as simplifying as possible. So this story gets sort of at that with on the beans front. Researchers assessed the effect of increased bean and pulse consumption in the typical U.S. dietary pattern on shortfall nutrient intakes and diet quality outcomes. According to the findings, dietary patterns that are rich in beans and pulses are associated with significantly higher diet quality scores and greater intake of shortfall nutrients, including nutrients of public health concern. Pulses are the edible seeds of plants in the legume family. Pulses grow in pods and come in a variety of shapes, sizes, and colors, and include beans, peas, chickpeas, and lentils. For this study, canned and dried kidney beans, black beans, chickpeas, pinto beans were included in the composite. Using data from the National Health and Examination Survey from 2001 to 2018, the analysis modeled the addition of 1 or 2 servings of beans in adults. Results show that greater consumption of beans is associated with significant increases in several shortfall nutrients, including dietary fiber, potassium, magnesium, iron, folate, and choline. Impact on diet quality. Additionally, the addition of 1 to 2 servings of beans daily to the U.S. typical dietary pattern significantly increased overall diet quality, as assessed by USDA's Healthy Eating Index. Total scores were 15% greater with an additional serving of beans and 19% greater with 2 servings of beans relative to the U.S. typical dietary pattern. In both younger and older adults, This evaluation showed that beans contributed to a substantial increase in daily dietary fiber intake. This is critical since fewer than 1 in 10 U.S. adults meet fiber recommendations to maintain optimal digestive health and prevent chronic diseases, including cardiovascular disease, diabetes, obesity, and certain cancers. And I would add on that, that actually what the recommendations are in the U.S., you could probably, if you were trying to actually get to optimal, I would probably at least double or triple that amount. Additionally, the majority of U.S. adults fall short in meeting potassium recommendations. According to the American Heart Association, foods with potassium can help control blood pressure by blunting the effects of sodium, and the more potassium you eat, the more sodium you process out of your body. The research clearly shows that eating beans and pulses is good, but eating more is better. Beans and pulses are excellent sources of fiber, folate, and potassium, and excellent sources of plant protein that also provide iron and zinc like other protein foods. Beans and pulses remain underconsumed in the United States, with greater than 80% of the population below recommendations. Consumption data show beans, peas, and legumes are consumed in relatively small amounts, at an average of a tenth of a cup a day. So that would be 0.7 cups a week. Huh, I would say shoot for a cup a day and two or three if you can. Go to it. I find that beans are the most underrated food in the American diet, and it's almost kind of funny or ironic that it's seen as a poor people's food when it is the richest in nutrition at one of the lowest costs. Okay, well, next up, let's get at healthy movement behaviors, and this is for little kids from Medical Express. Little kids, too little movement. Global study finds most children don't meet guidelines. Appropriate levels of physical activity, sedentary behavior, and sleep, collectively termed movement behaviors, are essential for the healthy growth and development of preschool-age children. Considering the extensive benefits of movement behaviors, it is very alarming that a recent study found that only 1 in 7 preschoolers, or 14%, around the world are meeting movement behavior guideline recommendations. A 24-hour day in the life of a preschooler meeting a guideline includes 3 or more hours of total physical activity, including at least 1 hour of energetic play or activities that make them slightly out of breath, 1 hour or less of screen time, and 10 to 13 hours of good quality sleep. Importantly, preschoolers who meet these guidelines gain health benefits such as reduced risk of obesity, improved social and emotional skills, and proficient motor skills. When looking at each movement behavior individually for preschoolers around the world, 49% met the physical activity recommendations, 42% met the screen time recommendation, and 81% met the sleep recommendation. That most young children are not meeting each of these basic recommendations separately is cause for concern. That 86% are not meeting all guideline recommendations combined is alarming and places preschoolers around the world at a risk of substandard health and development. So, as I've reported before, the world's getting increasingly sedentary, and this combination for young kids for total physical activity, for reduced screen time and good quality sleep of 10 to 13 hours a day for preschoolers is essential for their development. Okay, well, next up, as global climate change ravages many communities, we're often focused on the immediate deaths, but this is a fascinating study about the long-term effects. This is from Axios. Hurricanes kill thousands long after they hit a community. Hurricanes and tropical storms have long-term health consequences, generating 7,000 to 11,000 excess deaths over the 15 years following an event, a new study finds. The study demonstrates that long-term public health impacts are a concern in the wake of Hurricane Helene's devastating damage and long after direct deaths and damage is accounted for. Until recently, most of the attention has been focused on direct causes of death, such as drownings from flood waters, rather than the complex cascade of events that can elevate mortality long after a storm fizzles. The new research published in the journal Nature shows many higher excess deaths from the social and economic upheaval left in the wake of tropical cyclones in the U.S. than expected. Co-author Solomon Tseng of Stanford University told Axios, In fact, the study shows that tropical cyclones account for roughly 3.2 to 5.1% of all deaths annually in the lower 48 states, or between 55,000 and 88,000 excess deaths each year. The lack of research on indirect deaths long after storms hit, often from stresses that worsen cancer, heart disease, and other chronic conditions, has hidden the full health burden of these storms, as well as the extent to which this accounts for broad-scale patterns of mortality. The study included all 501 tropical cyclones that affected the continental U.S. coastline between 1930 and 2015. It estimates the change in monthly state mortality rates from 1950 to 2015 for the 20 years after each storm hit the country. Whereas the National Oceanic and Administrative Agency reported that the 501 storms studied caused an average of 24 direct deaths, the paper estimates that the average tropical storm or hurricane indirectly accelerated the death of between 7,000 and 11,000 people for each of the storms. Southeastern states have the highest proportion of deaths attributed to tropical cyclones, including 13% of total deaths in Florida and 11% of deaths in North Carolina. During the study period, tropical cyclones contributed to more deaths in the U.S. between 3.6 to 5.2 million than motor vehicle injuries and infectious diseases. So that's good context. I like to see them reporting that. So it's not something that shows up on the death certificate that you died of a tropical storm. But when you look at the larger effects of what's really happening, what upstream is causing health problems and death, there's a lot of things that happen in the wake of a storm that lead to bad health outcomes. Okay, well, next up, I have kind of an interesting public health case study that really looks at the costs of fatal falls among older adults and comparing those to firearm deaths. This is from Medical Express. Costs of fatal falls among U.S. older adults exceed those attributed to firearm deaths. The cost of fatal falls among older people 45 and older exceed those of firearm deaths in the U.S., finds research published in the Open Access Journal, Trauma, Surgery, and Acute Care, Open. The stark economics and shifting age demographics in the U.S. underscore the urgency of preventive measures, conclude the researchers. Falls account for around 1 in 5 of all injury-related hospital admissions, and the World Health Organization reports that falls are the second leading cause of unintentional injury deaths worldwide, and the over 65s especially vulnerable. Like falls, firearm-related injuries and deaths take a significant economic toll, but firearm injuries disproportionately affect younger age groups, exacting a greater financial impact on years of potential life loss and productivity. The researchers looked at data for everyone ages 15 and over. The years of potential life loss for fatal falls was about 1.5 million potential years of life loss, and almost 9 million for firearm deaths. So there's a huge difference there in years of potential life loss, where firearm deaths is like about 6 times higher. But the total medical costs of fatal falls across all age groups were significantly higher than those for firearm injuries. In 2015 to 2020, the average medical costs were about $1.5 billion for fatal falls, compared to about $250 million for firearm deaths. And of course, a lot of this is because the cascade of healthcare costs that comes from older people falling can be hugely expensive. And while firearm injuries can be fairly expensive too and lead to some permanent disability, the deaths themselves are actually less expensive. But of course, this leads to huge amounts of years of potential life loss because the firearm deaths are happening in much younger people than most of the serious and fatal falls. And of course, the firearm deaths, you have to continually remember that a majority of that is actually suicides. And with firearm suicides or suicide attempts, there's a high rate of success. So there aren't actually a lot of medical costs associated with it. You just have someone who's dead. Okay, well, next up, let's turn to a series of environmental health stories. This from Medical Express. From kitchenware to toys, household items linked to toxic flame retardants. From toys to kitchenware to food takeout trays, researchers have discovered a toxic chemical banned for its link to cancer in many common household items. Exposure to flame retardant can come with serious health risks. Published in the journal Chemisphere, researchers discovered 9 toxic flame retardants in household items containing black plastic. Some of the items had high concentrations of the chemicals, up to 2.3% by weight. In 70% of the samples tested, they found traces of DECA-BDE, a retardant banned by the EPA in 2021. But newer retardants were also found, including a hormone-disrupting chemical recently detected in human breast milk. The dangerous chemicals are likely making their way into household items through poor recycling practices. We know that some electronics companies put highly hazardous flame retardants in their products and thought it was pretty likely that some of that flame retarded plastic would be recycled and make it their way into household items like toys and kitchen utensils. And that's what we found. Flame retardants linked to cancer and hormone disruption are ending up in products we use for eating and preparing food, or that our kids play with. The most common flame retardants, PBDEs, can disrupt brain development in children, have been linked to greater cancer risk. Bromophenols, PBDE alternatives, can affect fetal development, have been detected in both placenta and breast milk. Some advice on how to avoid contamination: avoid black plastic where food and children are involved. For example, replace black plastic kitchen utensils with plastic-free wooden or stainless steel ones, and opt for reusable glass containers instead of keeping and reusing black plastic takeout containers. So this is a kind of horrific side effect of actually trying to recycle things, is that downstream from recycling, when you're recycling very toxic substances, some of those toxic substances get into the new products and are used in different settings in different ways that can harm human health. And next up, another story on the kind of ubiquity of plastic chemicals, this from The Hill. Southern California study demonstrates extensive exposure to airborne plasticizers. Urban populations in Southern California are facing chronic exposure to toxic airborne plasticizer compounds, two of which have already been banned from children's products, a new study has found. Plasticizers are commonly used chemicals that serve the purpose of making materials more flexible, appearing in a wide range of products, from food containers to shower curtains to gardening equipment to textiles. Despite regulatory efforts to minimize public exposure to the plasticizers, most notorious for causing cancer, death, birth defects, and reproductive harm, the presence of some compounds has persisted, according to the study published in Environmental Research. The level of these compounds are through the roof, said corresponding author David Volz, an environmental sciences professor at University of California, Riverside. While previous research efforts in the Golden State have monitored the presence of specific types of plasticizers called orthophthalates, some of which were phased out of production due to health and environmental concerns, the scientists were interested in examining the presence of their replacements, known as non-orthophthalates. But ultimately, they determined both types of plasticizers have persisted in the air throughout Southern California. To draw the conclusions, the researchers tracked two groups of UC undergraduate students who wore silicone wristbands designed to collect airborne chemical exposure data. Each group commuted to the campus from different parts of Southern California. At the end of each collection period, the researchers said they chopped their silicone bracelets into pieces and analyzed the chemicals they contained. Concentrations of these chemicals were similar to those identified in unrelated studies on the East Coast. So while this is a Southern California study, this has actually been shown in other places on the other side of the country, thus the ubiquity of these chemicals. No matter who you are or where you are, your daily level of exposure to these plasticizer chemicals is high and persistent. They are ubiquitous. Of course, that doesn't mean that you can't modify your exposure to these somewhat, but the fact is they're so ubiquitous that virtually every human being is exposed to these chemicals. Okay, next up, an interesting story. This from Stat News. Racial disparities in cancer may come from pollutants. Across all kinds of cancer, Black Americans have higher rates of mortality and often more aggressive forms of the disease. A growing body of research suggests the reason may not have to do with African ancestry as much as social and environmental factors like racism, housing discrimination, and, according to a new study, exposure to pollution. The study, published in Nature Communications, found that in several types of cancer, black patients had more cancers with extra copies of genes. But the team found that these genetic duplications, which can make cancers more aggressive, didn't seem to be linked to anything ancestral, that is, from genes. Rather, the team reported genetic duplications were more likely in cells exposed to pollutants, which, of course, black folks are exposed to more. What this paper hints at is what we're seeing something which looks like a genetic difference, but the source of what might actually not be genetic, it's more environmental, said Kanika Arora, a computational biologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering, who is not involved with the new study. We treat patients, we treat their tumor, and then we send them right back into the environment, which we're saying is causing their cancer. But then we don't give them any additional information, she said. If it truly is that exposure that's driving the cancer, we need to then work with our communities to be more informed and then drive policies around that. Once again, proving that the environment and social determinants are often behind these things and give us very limited individual choices that we can make to mitigate these health concerns. We need to solve these problems communally, collectively. That's what public health is all about. Okay, well, next up, an example of the success of investigative journalism. This from the Environmental Health Network. Chevron's cancer-causing fuel forced EPA to rethink approval. The EPA's plans to reconsider Chevron's approval to produce plastic-based fuels after discovering one fuel's cancer risk could be more than a million times the acceptable level. The EPA approved Chevron in 2022 to make 18 plastic-based fuels, some with a very high cancer risk. The agency now admits there may have been an error in its original decision after environmental groups raised concerns. That was reported by ProPublica and I reported on earlier. Chevron has not yet begun making the chemicals, but litigation is ongoing regarding their potential health risks. Why this matters? Producing plastic-based fuels could expose entire communities to dangerous cancer risks. With the EPA reconsidering its approval, the outcome may set a precedent for regulating high-risk chemical production. And this whole effort by Chevron is just the example of how any kind of plastic production is really a whole fossil fuels, petroleum-based economic model. If we're taking plastics and then eventually trying to use them for fuel, it's just one more way of burning fossil fuels. And in this case, even more dangerous because you have all the other chemicals present in those plastics. But as this next story gets at, often economic concerns override public health or environmental concerns. This from the Environmental Health Network. Biden to sign bill easing environmental reviews for chip production projects. President Biden is expected to sign a bill allowing semiconductor manufacturers to bypass certain federal environmental reviews, sparking debate among Democrats over its potential environmental impact. The bill would exempt some semiconductor projects from National Environmental Policy Act reviews to speed up U.S. chip production. Supporters say the bill is necessary to strengthen the U.S. economy and national security by reducing reliance on foreign-made semiconductors. Critics argue the bill weakens environmental protections and reduces transparency on the use of harmful chemicals in manufacturing. A key quote here from the top Democrat in the National Natural Resources Committee, a piece of legislation that allows these facilities to completely bypass the National Environmental Policy Act's critical environmental review and public input processes, while also stripping communities' right to legally challenge these projects under the National Environmental Policy Act, is unconscionable and never, under any circumstances, should have been pushed through the House. Why this matters? Semiconductors power everything from smartphones to military equipment. Accelerating chip production is key for U.S. economic and security goals, but fast-tracking projects without proper environmental oversight risk public health and environmental harm. Wow, what if national security actually included a safe environment to live in? What a novel idea. Okay, well, next up, I have a nice little story about unintended side effects. This from the Environmental Health Network. Ship scrubbers meant to clean fuel are causing ocean pollution. New research shows that ship scrubbers designed to reduce sulfur emissions have unintentionally caused heavy metal pollution, damaging marine ecosystems. Ship scrubbers have reduced sulfur pollution, but release heavy metals into the ocean, harming marine life. More than 10 billion cubic meters of scrubber water is discharged annually, causing $750 million in environmental damage in the Baltic Sea alone. Some governments, including Sweden and Denmark, plan to ban open-loop scrubbers by 2029 to mitigate further harm. Ship scrubbers were initially seen as a solution to reduce sulfur pollution, but their unintended impact on marine ecosystems has proven costly. Addressing this issue is crucial to protecting ocean biodiversity and reducing further environmental damage. This is one reason why consuming less and simply doing less is often the best solution, as many of our active solutions sometimes cause as much or more damage than the original problem. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, next up, a story on medical debt. This is from The Hill. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau warns of illegal debt collection tactics in healthcare. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau issued a consumer advisory to combat families being targeted by, quote, illegal medical debt collection tactics. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau cited tactics violating federal law that debt collectors have employed when it comes to medical bills, including double billing for services covered by insurance, collecting amounts that exceed federal or state caps, falsifying or exaggerating charges, collecting on unsubstantiated bills, and misrepresenting payment obligations and consumers' ability to contest bills. Medical billing is often riddled with errors, including inflated or duplicative charges, fees for services the patient never received, or charges already paid, said the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau Director Rohit Chopra. Medical debt is one of the most common forms of debt represented on credit cards, or credit reports. The Biden administration earlier this year moved to ban medical debt from being included on credit reports. Medical debt advocacy groups like Undo Medical Debt praise this rule, noting that unlike other forms of debt, medical debt is not a good indicator of someone's creditworthiness. While student loan debt or car loans are incurred knowingly with predetermination, people can't predict when or how sick they will be in the future. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau guidance advised that people receiving calls from debt collectors for medical bills should request a detailed list of charges, sometimes called a super bill, negotiate the amount owed, submit a complaint to the Bureau if a debt collector is engaged in federally illegal tactics, and sue collectors if these laws are being violated. Hospitals and other healthcare providers in the United States are increasingly outsourcing medical billing and collection activities to third parties, such as revenue cycle management firms, who may have legal obligations under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, the Bureau's advisory stated. Okay, well, next up, have a story on the long and winding road to cannabis decriminalization and what policy issues that may bring forth. This from the Associated Press. U.S. health authorities need to play a larger role in cannabis policy, a new report says. With more Americans using ever stronger marijuana, a federal advisory panel is calling for the public health approach. That's a big departure from just say no. This new report proposes a health-focused strategy, with the CDC taking a larger role in cannabis policy than ever before. An estimated 18 million Americans report using marijuana daily or near daily, more than the number who drink alcohol that often. Today, 38 states and D.C. allow the medical use of marijuana, and many of those states also allow adult recreational use, with taxes and regulation of sales similar to alcohol. Florida voters will decide on recreational use this November. Marijuana remains illegal under federal law, although the government is taking steps to reclassify cannabis as a less dangerous drug while still illegal. Cannabis is getting stronger, with levels of the intoxicating compound THC rising. 25 years ago, cannabis flower contained about 5% THC. Now you go into stores, it's hard to find products that are less than 20% THC, said Bo Kilmer, co-director of the RAND Drug Policy Research Center and a report committee member. Cannabis can ease chronic pain, but evidence on other health benefits has been limited by lack of research. The risk for heavy users includes car accidents, repeated bouts of vomiting, which can send people to the emergency room. For teens, cannabis can get in the way of learning and increase the risk of mood and anxiety disorders. Regular use during pregnancy can raise risk for the baby. Public health took a back seat as states passed cannabis laws. Financial interests played a substantial role in influencing these policies. According to the report, industry lobbying has prevented attempts in Washington state to limit THC concentration and attempts in Colorado to restrict pesticides in cannabis cultivation. Among the report's recommendations for the CDC, develop and evaluate health campaigns about cannabis, specifically for parents, young people, pregnant women, and people 65 and older. Monitor cannabis cultivation, sales, use, and health impacts. Create best practices for state regulation, including ways to limit youth access. For Congress, remove restrictions on the Office of National Drug Control Policy that prevent it from studying the effects of cannabis legalization. And for states, require training and certification for cannabis retail staff. Automatically expunge or seal records for low-level cannabis-related offenses in states that have decriminalized cannabis. Adopt and enforce quality standards set by the U.S. Pharmacopeia, an independent group that sets standards in medicines and dietary supplements. Okay, well, next up, a story from NBC News. 1 in 3 teens can't get tampons or pads during their period, study finds. A third of teens and young adults in the U.S. can't afford or otherwise access menstrual products, according to new research from the Children's National Hospital in Washington, D.C. The study found that period poverty, that is, insufficient access to menstrual hygiene products and related education, appears to affect young people equally, despite differences in race, ethnicity, neighborhood, or whether they have health insurance. We were really surprised at how widespread of an issue this is, said Dr. Monica Goyle, a pediatric emergency medicine specialist and co-director of the Center for Translational Research at Children's National. Teens and young adults were said to be experiencing period poverty if they said they had either had to use rags or tissues during their period over the past year or didn't have the money to buy tampons or pads. Goyle said the findings aren't rooted in the occasional situations that most women have found themselves in, being caught off guard by the start of an early cycle without a menstrual product on hand. When young women are forced to use unhygienic products such as rags or menstrual products that have already been used, it greatly increases the risk of bacterial infections in the vagina and urinary tract. Some young people may skip school, sports, or other social activities because of a lack of access to menstrual products. Previous research has linked period poverty to depression among college-aged women. While prices of menstrual products and spot shortages in tampons may affect some women more significantly than others, study co-author Malia Boyle, a staff scientist at Children's National, said the new findings held regardless of race or socioeconomic status. Youth who are living in neighborhoods with high opportunity had similar rates of experiencing menstrual inequity as those living in areas of neighborhoods that were underserved, Boyle said. This is impacting everyone. Some states are passing legislation to increase access to menstrual products in schools. Starting in 2024, Minnesota law requires public schools to provide them for free to any student in need, starting in the fourth grade. Alabama, California, Colorado, Illinois, Maine, Maryland, and New Mexico have similar laws, according to AntFlow, a company that supplies schools and businesses with menstrual products that can be given to students and employees for free. Women's health in general has been deprioritized, Goyle said. Just like toilet paper is readily available in all restrooms, we'd love to see improved access to free menstrual products everywhere. Amen to that. Basic need should not be something unmet. Okay, well, last up in the regular reporting, this from Kaiser Family Foundation Health News. Here's why getting a COVID shot during pregnancy is important. Nearly 90% of babies who had to be hospitalized with COVID-19 had mothers who didn't get the vaccine while they were pregnant, according to new data released by the CDC. The findings appear in the agency's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. Babies too young to be vaccinated had the highest COVID hospitalization rate of any age group except those over 75 years of age. Babies can't get the COVID vaccination until they're at least 6 months old. That leaves a huge window when infants are most vulnerable. Vaccinating pregnant women so they pass the antibodies on to their newborns is an effective way of protecting babies during this time. Vaccination during pregnancy also protects pregnant people from severe disease, which of course can affect the mom and the baby as well. And this window in early life, the first 6 months or a year of life, is a very vulnerable time for little kids and respiratory issues, whether it's COVID-19 or RSV or any kind of respiratory infection. Okay, well, that brings us to our last feature, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. 31 bonus articles this week, so let's get rolling. First up, hurricane sends new shutters through health supply chain. So just one of the many effects of a hurricane is that it can shut down medical supply companies that are producing things needed throughout the country and even the world. And that was true in this hurricane as well, Hurricane Helene. Bonus article 2, hospitals still feeling impacts of Hurricane Helene. So, of course, a lot of this, most hospitals have backup generators, but when your entire water system goes out and you can't even flush toilets and you're using buckets, that is not a good situation. Although I would point out that worldwide, over 1 in 5 healthcare facilities don't have access to clean water. Bonus article 3, North Carolina was once a climate leader, but more than a decade of Republican and corporate obstruction left the state ill-prepared for the historic disaster. So this is just an example of upstream where public policy comes from. It matters on the ground. And moving from a climate leader to climate denial can kill us. Bonus article 4, World Health Organization approves first Mpox diagnostic tests. So this is good to speed up the ability to be able to track the disease and follow its progression, which is good for surveillance besides just individual diagnosis. Bonus article 5, sex workers find themselves at the center of the Mpox outbreak in the Congo. So the Congo is the center of the Mpox outbreak, and at the center of that is sex workers. Now, of course, this is another great example of how large social determinants and social conditions can vastly affect the progress of an epidemic. In this case, sex workers that are there by the tens of thousands to service gold miners and other miners in the Congo has led to a rapid transmission of Mpox. Bonus article 6. Next pandemic could start in the U.S., disease experts warn. This is largely emanating out of the flu, bird flu pandemic that we're seeing that is now present in cows and 50-plus mammal species, and the fact that we have 10 billion livestock animals every year in the U.S. This is kind of a perfect storm. And something that is actually worse in the U.S. than most places around the world. Bonus article 7, California confirms first human cases of bird flu in the state. It's up to 3, I think, as today. And, of course, California is the largest milk producer in the country. They're doing a little bit more aggressive tracking evidence stuff, so we'd expect that we're going to see some human cases. And, of course, everybody's got their eye out for human-to-human transmission. Hasn't been documented yet, but that's the big fear. But even if we were to dodge that bullet, bonus article 8 gets at another problem. Superbugs could devastate livestock globally. So even if bird flu doesn't become a human flu pandemic, we can see that antimicrobial resistance, for instance, from the heavy use of livestock can actually devastate the livestock industry. Yeah, what goes around comes around, and human health and animal health in our larger environment share a lot of realities and a future fate. Bonus article 9. After a rocky debut for new RSV tools, hopes are high as a new season approaches. So last week I reported that 56% of new babies were protected either by the maternal vaccine or the infant antibodies, and that was the first year it was used. I think that's actually pretty good, but it's pretty complicated with the timing and stuff. So if you're a parent who has a newbie who might be wanting to get either pregnant or a new parent, or interested in that, maybe a grandparent, you might want to read this article. Bonus article 10, U.S. school entry vaccination rates fall as exemptions keep rising. So once we get to that, after the regular immunizations of childhood, it's when they enter school that there's requirements about vaccination. And we're seeing that going down because states have increasingly allowed other exemptions. Medical exemptions haven't really changed, but kind of optional ones based on people's beliefs have gone up. Now, this is just ticking it away, but the part of the key is these differ in so many different places and in different communities that you're going to see larger pockets of drops. And this, of course, is where you can get a foothold for vaccine-related infectious diseases. And of course, that is dangerous for those people, but can keep the ball passing on and endanger others. Bonus Article 11, COVID-19 outpatient antiviral treatment among adults age 65 and over is lower with increasing age as risk increases. So this is kind of weird that the highest risk people are the oldest people, but the use of these antiviral treatments actually goes down. And this is even true when you control for different comorbidities and stuff. So not a particularly good trend. Maybe it's not a little bit of ageism there, not valuing our older folks quite as much, thinking, ah, what the heck. Bonus Article 12. Remember the shortage of medical gowns during COVID? Fed spending $350 million for 90-day stockpile. So this is part of the, you know, the National Reserve stockpile for all kinds of medical equipment and drugs and vaccines and that kind of thing. And of course, remember when healthcare workers were wearing garbage bags and stuff? We want to avoid that in case of another pandemic. So the feds are going to have a 90-day supply for the low, low price of $350 million. Bonus Article 13. As climate change helps mosquitoes spread disease, critics push for alternative to pesticides. So that's a common way that, and actually in Lucas County, we have a very active and one of the older kind of mosquito control units in the country, considered a big success. But of course, using pesticides has some health risks along with it as well. Of course, the best way to keep mosquitoes down is don't allow places for them to breed, you know, don't have puddles of water, standing water, that kind of thing. But there are other alternatives, and we shouldn't necessarily just use chemical exposures. Bonus Article 14, UK's last coal plant could be repurposed into a giant battery. So this is really two stories. The first, woohoo, way to go, United Kingdom. They no longer have any coal power plants. They decommissioned the last one. And the good news on that is that they've used a lot of these facilities to use energy storage, and they're repurpose it into a giant battery so that you can even out the flow of renewable sources by storing energy when you can bring in a lot of energy, and then when you're using a lot, you can take it out of the giant battery. Bonus Article 15, bottled water has a huge and growing toll on human and planetary health. So this is just another example of, you know, we like the convenience, and some people think it's a lot healthier to drink bottled water, but of course, with microplastics and such, and sometimes tap water is actually healthier than the bottled water. But of course, planetary health is a big issue as far as microplastic and plastic pollution. Bonus Article 16. Experts call for more studies on health effects of microplastics in cosmetic and personal care products. So what I reported on earlier about the ubiquity of many of these chemicals is also true for many everyday products that we use. Bonus Article 17, an example of such research, PFAS exposure linked to sleep disruptions in young adults. So particularly these chemicals that are endocrine disrupting can cause a lot of problems, and it looks like there's a connection to sleep disruptions in young adults. Bonus Article 18, toxic contamination of our oceans can reach our kitchen tables. DDT looms. So this particular story is really focusing on these thousands and thousands of barrels of DDT dumped off the coast of California decades ago. And this is leaking, and it's affecting marine populations and moving up the food chain, the marine food chain. But regulatory, we don't really have, a lot of them have very narrow things that they measure. Nobody's really looking specifically at something than that is a ticking time bomb. So something we should be doing. Bonus Article 19, radon, even at levels below EPA guideline for mitigation, is linked to childhood leukemia, which is the most common childhood cancer. So radon is usually comes out of the ground, and it's based on the type of rock formations in your area. The good news is for Northwest Ohio, we have low radon levels generally, so it's not a huge issue here. But here, once again, the more we learn, it's not good news. We find that there's substantial health problems even at lower levels than have been previously determined. Bonus Article 20. Condoms aren't a fact of life for young Americans. They're an afterthought. So as somebody who spent my professional life as an AIDS program director in the 1990s, dealt a lot with condoms, and the relationship with condoms has changed a lot over time. This is an interesting read about how all that has changed in the last 30 or so years. Bonus Article 21. Colorectal cancer screening uptake tripled in the 45 to 49 age group after there were updated recommendations to screen that age group. So there's some good news that those recommendations and the adoption of them can make a difference. Bonus Article 22. Haunted by migrant deaths, Border Patrol agents face mental health toll. So Border Patrol agents can face, you might call this moral injury, of having to deal with the carnage of migrant deaths in that whole process of migrants and refugees coming into the country in kind of in a chaotic fashion, which often leads to people's deaths. It can be traumatic for Border Patrol agents as well, witnessing that. And a somewhat related story, bonus Article 23, desperate families see potential in San Francisco's new mental health court, but very few are helped so far. And the reason I say it's related is because really what we're seeing is law enforcement, whether it's a Border Patrol or a San Francisco municipal court, actually law enforcement is not really the best to deal with mental health problems or homelessness. And that's just what we're seeing here. Bonus Article 24, Florida enacts tough law criminalizing homelessness, leaving cities and counties scrambling. So ever since the Supreme Court allowed basically the criminalization of homelessness, different places around the country have been ramping up and unfortunately criminalizing homelessness, leaving homeless folks no options as they're simply existing in a public space becomes criminal, not good. Bonus Article 25, even political rivals agree that medical debt is an urgent issue. So there's some bipartisan agreement that medical debt is a problem. There is an empathy or a sympathy that people's lives should not be to the vagaries of unpredictable health issues, and your entire family wealth can be wiped out by one health problem. Bonus Article 26, FDA's promise guidance on pulse oximeters unlikely to end decades of racial bias. So this is what measures the oxygen and has been shown to not work as well with people with darker skin. But the guidelines are rather weak and actually don't even really require any kind of substantial testing among actual people of color. So still an issue. Bonus Article 27, setting the record straight on the FDA's authority over drug ads. So I had reported in the bonus section a week or two ago about drug ads and how they're kind of sketchy. And anybody who's seen them you don't have to be a genius, a PhD, to know that that drug ads are a mess. And the United States and New Zealand are the only places in the country that you can do direct-to-consumer drug ads. But the FDA pointed out some discrepancies in that article. So if you want to see some of the articulation of what they have to do in order to regulate these drug ads, good article. Bonus Article 28, it's time for a new medical specialty in asynchronous care, answering patient inbox questions. So this would be a specialist that would really basically be answering inbox questions for doctors who spend over an hour a day answering these questions. And there's a real art and science behind it, and they're proposing it as a new medical specialty. Like, for instance, there's hospitalists who only work in the hospital because the conditions and the things that show up in the hospital are different enough from regular outpatient care that having somebody specialize in that can be of benefit. Bonus Article 29. Expert panel calls for nutrition competencies in U.S. medical education. I've reported many times that U.S. medical education has almost no nutrition expertise required or education given. So, hey, let's do this. Dietary risks are the number one cause of chronic conditions in the U.S. Doctors should be able to speak competently about it. Bonus article 30. Benefits of adding fluoride to water may be waning with the widespread use of fluoride in toothpaste. So to some extent, this is the success of just diminishing returns. Early on, the fluoridation of water when toothpaste wasn't fluoridated or people weren't using it as widely, the benefits from the fluoride to teeth and bones was a lot more. But now that fluoride in toothpaste is very widespread, that the additional benefit that you get from fluoride in water, even though it was kind of the first to come about, is waning. So some of your success leads to the problem. Just a simple rule of diminishing returns. Doesn't necessarily mean that you should stop doing what you're doing, but the proportion of the problem that it's dealing with is less because there's other tactics such as fluoride in toothpaste that can bring you some of the benefit as well. And also just over the last 50, 60, 70 years, the amount of fluoridated water and food supply has gone so global. It isn't regional like it was before. Like we used to get a lot of goiters because there were certain people were eating local and regional foods that were low in iodine. But now people's food, the average bite comes from like 1,500 miles. So iodine's not a problem. Similar in some respects with fluoride. Bonus article 31, kids no longer smoke cigarettes. Why aren't we celebrating? So the decline in youth smoking is a massive public health success, and it has dropped phenomenally in the last 20 or 30 years. But of course, we in public health are good at assessing problems, always on to the next thing, but we should stop and celebrate this fact that if we can keep kids from picking up cigarettes in the first place, then you can have a whole generation a whole lot healthier. You can read these and all the other articles I've reported on in this episode and earlier episodes by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-